You're listening to Giles Brown on TRE Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain. Hunter S. Thompson is often remembered as a caricature, drug-addled but sharp-witted. In all this entertainment, the true figure of Thompson has been forgotten, but there was much to teach us in these new political times. Freak Kingdom offers a brash, brilliant recounting of the decade during which Thompson found his calling and how his activist journalism shaped a generation. As the Kennedy assassination and the turmoil of the 60s paved the way for Richard Nixon, Thompson greeted the new president with two very powerful emotions, fear and loathing. It's the subject of Freak Kingdom, a new book by Timothy Denevi. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the US, Timothy himself. Timothy, good morning to you.
Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is all mine. It's too easy to think of Hunter S. Thompson as being all sex, drugs, rock and roll, and a bit of writing on the side. He was so much more of that. But for those who aren't aware of the man, give us a little bit of a background about who Hunter S. Thompson actually was.
Hunter Thompson was born in 1937 in Louisville, Kentucky. And at a young age, after high school, he left and really started out on a career as a freelance writer. And for the next decade, between the early 1960s and the early 1970s, he covered politics throughout the United States, up and down South America, and carved out a niche for himself that went far beyond what we tend to imagine of him today through movies like Terry Gilliam's Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. And by that I mean that he was a very serious, on-point, everyday freelance journalist who was fighting against corruption, whether he saw that corruption in Lima, Peru, or whether he saw that corruption in San Francisco, California, or he saw it in his hometown of Louisville, Kentucky, or he saw it in Los Angeles, or towards the end of his that part of his career, if he saw it in the White House, in Richard Milhouse Nixon, who from the start, from the Kennedy assassination, even before that, was the dark muse for Hunter Thompson's career and the embodiment of the injustice and manipulation of the American system that he saw plaguing the country that he grew up in.
Because, you know, Thompson was a serious journalist, a serious writer. You know, he traveled to Cuba, he wrote, you know, the Rum Diaries, etc. And also his politics, his interest in politics, because people will tend to think of him purely through his Rolling Stone, and as you say, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. But he had an extremely sharp brain, and he had an interest in politics that, you know, saw him running. Didn't he run as his independent candidate in Aspen, Colorado?
Yeah, he ran for sheriff in Aspen, Colorado, where he ended up settling at the end of the 1960s. One of the seminal moments for Hunter S. Thompson and for America at that time was the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Hunter Thompson was on the street with other journalists and delegates from the Democratic Party who were beaten viciously by Mayor Richard Daley's police force. And Thompson knew at that moment that if political operatives within the United States were willing to use violence to silence dissent, and they could do anything they wanted. He returned then afterward to Aspen, Colorado. This was after then Nixon won the election. And he thought that if he couldn't affect change necessarily on a national level, which he had tried to do through protests and through writing, then the least he could do was affect change on a personal level within the community that he lived. So he ran for sheriff of Aspen, Colorado. He also ran a mayoral campaign, was the head of it for Aspen, Colorado. And throughout both those campaigns, he dictated to his constituents and rallied around citizens of his county that he lived in, a push towards what justice should be. And it worked. You know, he didn't end up winning the sheriff campaign, but he ended up changing Aspen for the better by fighting against development, fighting for environmental regulation, and fighting for civil rights in the way that the sheriff had been abusing so many of the citizens kind of rampantly. And, you know, people forget that he wasn't just a political thinker, but he was also a political activist at the same time. And those two, in a sense, would eventually merge as he would then, in the early 1970s, take up a gig with Rolling Stone and write about Richard Nixon on the campaign trail.
When did Nixon first come across his political radar then? When did he first start to notice Nixon and write about Nixon?
Well, 1960 was when Nixon really came on his radar. Hunter Thompson was hitchhiking up and down the West Coast in the fall of 1960, and he was at a turnpike in Oregon, someplace he knew he'd never pass through again, and he watched for the first time Nixon debate John F. Kennedy on television. He had known Nixon was a slimeball. He had known about the Checkers incident when Nixon was a vice presidential candidate for Eisenhower in the 1950s, and Nixon had been accused of shady dealings then. But for Thompson to watch Nixon and his used car salesman demeanor in 1960 in that debate sort of galvanized him on crookedness in American politics, where somebody can say something right to you and the audience can know that that person is lying and they can support him anyways. And so when John F. Kennedy was killed in 1963, Thompson wrote a series of letters, and that night he couldn't sleep. He was worried the United States was about to go to war because this one threat the United States had been dealing with for so many years, communist threat that so many politicians had made their career on, had now manifested itself and taken out the head of the American government. And in one of his letters, Thompson writes, "And now is the time that that beast Nixon is going to slink back into view." He said that'd be the scariest, one of the scariest results of the JFK assassination, is it gives Nixon another path to electoral politics. And he was right. So the next year in 1964, during the Republican National Convention, as the Republicans nominated Barry Goldwater to run against Lyndon Johnson, Thompson was on the floor of that convention, and Richard Nixon came out from his political wilderness and introduced Barry Goldwater in his same kind of terrible used car salesman shtick. And Thompson knew then that one of the most horrible things that happens in American politics and in politics in general in the democracy is when the citizenry knows that the person on stage is telling lies and they mistake that for what we tend to see as an incredibly positive American trait, ambition.
Mm. I mean, you talk about the dark underbelly that Nixon represents, and if you read Thompson's writing, you know, it is visceral in his hatred for him. And if you read Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, which is a masterpiece, I mean, you could argue that Thompson represents, and some may be throwing their hands up in the air at this one, you know, he represents the true American spirit of the liberal, or at least those American ideas. And it's funny to think, or it might be quite a mind warp for people to think of Thompson as an upholder of the basic first constitutional values of freedom of speech, that was being, he saw being perverted by the rise of Nixon and through his party.
Yeah, Thompson was a patriot, which is a very strange way to identify him. What he was fighting for in the 1960s was for checks and balances within our electoral system of government. He had seen on so many different levels the most powerful people using the system to take advantage of the weak, when in fact the system should be functioning to prohibit them from doing so. He saw it with the police chief and the sheriff's department in Los Angeles, where his friend Oscar Zeta Acosta was fighting a civil rights battle against rampant police corruption and rampant police brutality at the time. He saw it in Washington. He saw it in Aspen. He saw it in Louisville. He saw it in South America. And, you know, his first wife once said that, people don't get this, but Hunter Thompson was a patriot. He believed that the United States system of government was meant to hold accountable people who tried to use their amount of power to keep from being in any way called out on the abuses that they were using to take over the system that they found themselves moving through. And so with Richard Nixon, he saw somebody who was using the IRS to attack his enemies. He saw somebody who was so vindictive, he was willing to break into his rivals' offices to find dirt on them, so that if he was ever attacked, Nixon could say, well, what about the Democrats? They do this. You know, that was one of the reasons for the Watergate break-in, was to find dirt on the Democratic Party. And so Thompson knew that Nixon wasn't playing by the same rules that Americans were playing by, and that gave Nixon a terrible advantage. Part of Thompson's subjectivity, his vitriol towards Nixon, is an attempt to, again, level the playing field and say, look, we've all agreed to function in this way in this American democracy, and this person refuses to do so. And as a result, he's an incredible threat to all of our livelihoods and future.
Was Nixon aware of Thompson? Was, I mean, because, you know, Thompson was writing for Rolling Stone.
Yeah, he was. I mean, they had a very complex car ride together in 1968 when Nixon returned to run for the Republican nomination in New Hampshire. And Thompson was doing a freelance article, and he spent 30 minutes in the back of a giant Mercury sedan with Richard Nixon. And what happened was Thompson had all these different questions that he wanted to ask him, but Nixon was very good at parrying and avoiding any questions that you directly put on him. So Thompson eventually just started to talk to Richard Nixon about American football, which is something that they both were fans of. So for the next 30 minutes, they talked about the Super Bowl. They talked about this different quarterback and receiver. And in retrospect, Thompson was able to say that this was the only time in his life where he knew that when Nixon was talking, he wasn't at the same time lying. He was actually telling the truth about something. But in the 1970s, when Thompson was writing for Rolling Stone, he applied for a press pass, and he did a wonderful job for 2 weeks in the fall of 1972 during Nixon's reelection campaign of, following Nixon, being on the actual campaign tour with Nixon, and dramatizing the way that Ron Ziegler, Nixon's press secretary, and other members of Nixon's administration actively contained and corralled the press and kept the press from seeing what was actually going on. Often the press were kept in very small pens away from Nixon when he got off the plane. When Nixon gave speeches, he gave them on closed-circuit televisions, so the press had to sit and gather together and watch a very blurry television while Nixon was off in some ballroom, giving a campaign event or speech. And Thompson dramatized that for Rolling Stone, and that pissed off and made angry the Nixon campaign a lot, because he was exposing what other different journalists weren't, which is how Nixon was manipulating objectivity and the press's deadlines and need for access to get a version of Richard Nixon out to the populace that, while being false, was incredibly beneficial to the Nixon campaign, and it paid off. Nixon ended up winning by 20 points against George McGovern, and they knew that Thompson, as a journalist, was one of the people out there that were calling them on that, but they had so much power that it didn't make as much of an impression. It would be another year until they began to reap the benefits of their deeply illegal activities from the Watergate break-in and other illegalities.
You make the point, you present the case in the book, that Thompson made a Faustian pact so that he could bring Nixon to justice, or could at least highlight what Nixon was up to, and his perverting of the American dream, with the relationships and the legendary drug and alcohol intakes. Just explain a little bit more about that.
Yeah, most people identify Thompson with the 1960s psychedelic movement, and especially through Fear and Loathing, but in reality, starting in 1964, Thompson was already at a young age, at 20, at 25, 26, a pretty bad alcoholic. He would often get up at 3 or 4 p.m. He'd drink from 4 p.m. then until 10 a.m. He'd work the entire time. And he took a drug called dexedrine, which is very similar to Adderall. It's like racemic amphetamine, amphetamine cut with salt. And this is different than how we imagined Thompson as this sort of drugged out character. In fact, the amphetamine allowed him to recover from alcohol or to function while being an alcoholic at a very high level. And so from early on, he sort of made a pact that he would not stop drinking. He'd not change his rhythm or his lifestyle. But with dexedrine, which was prescribed to him by a friend, back then it was not a Schedule II drug in America, he could just get it. He allowed himself to write at a very high level. He allowed himself to constantly be on the road doing interviews, doing other aspects of research, and doing other aspects of his sort of journalistic pursuit of truth and justice. And for 10 years, from 1964 to 1974, he burned very brightly. He was at many of the most important moments in American history at the time. He was at Nixon's inauguration. He was at Chicago. He was at both conventions in 1972. He was at the 1964 convention. And he recorded it beautifully and insightfully for all of time. But afterwards, as Nixon left and as, both that hard work and also the alcoholism began to take its toll, he kind of no longer could do what he once was able to do. And these 10 years stand as sort of a bright flame against his career afterwards, which never quite attained the same acuity and insightfulness that this that his writing in that time period did.
There's a wonderful passage, isn't there, about the high water mark. If you stand on the near the San Francisco Bay, you can almost see the high water mark where it hits in 68, which is one of Tunter's most lyrical passages of writing. Do you think that once his nemesis, if you like, had gone, then there was Hunter found himself with little to rail at and rage against?
Yeah, I was talking to somebody who knew Hunter Thompson in the 1980s, and he was pretty jaded, Thompson. He said, we fought so hard to throw Nixon out of Washington, D.C., and now the Reaganites all come in, and they are in some way just as crooked as Nixon was, and their policies are definitely as harmful to people that need the most in our society. I think he had a very good sense of being wrong, which is so important for a nonfiction writer. He believed, you know, in 1965, when he lived in San Francisco, he lived on the Haight-Ashbury at 318 Parnassus Street, right at the top of the Haight. He was there in the mid-1960s to see the social changes going on. And at first he believed that, you know, consciousness expansion, a lot of these ideals associated with the hippie movement and the San Francisco movement could change the world. But what he then saw living there was a generation of permanent cripples, a generation of failed seekers, you know, as he says, people that desperately assume that someone or something was guiding the light at the end of the tunnel. And so in his writing, he's so insightful about looking back at certain times where he can then analyze and characterize the hopes people had at those times, and also the naivete that was built into that, and the failures that then eventually mounted and came out. And I think even with Nixon, which is itself a high watermark, throw out a sort of evil king from the palace to do everything that he could in the Watergate hearings after he wrote Campaign Trail to make sure that this crooked American would never have a seat in our government, in our historical context. To do all of that and to still see that it might not have made, you know, to still see that we, 50 years later, have someone like Donald Trump as our president is deeply disheartening. And I just think that nonfiction writing, and especially his writing, is about looking at the past and understanding what we, where we wanted to be and where we ended up instead.
Interesting you should bring up the T word, the Donald, because I have often found myself wondering what and wishing that Thompson was still with us. Of course, he died. Refresh my memory when he actually passed away, Hunter.
He passed away in 2005.
Yeah.
In February of 2005.
Yeah. And but you find yourself, I mean, I often find myself thinking as I watch what's happening in the States now, what Hunter would have written about, what Thompson would have written about the Trump administration. You've talked about the Nixon administration, the control, the slickness, the whole thing, and we are seeing this, one might argue, in spades with the Trump presidency.
Well, you know, Hunter Thompson was very, very keen on the danger of the American presidency in the 1970s. He wrote about how you basically have to be a rock star to become president. You have to whip everybody up into a frenzy to become president. And he said that the worst thing about the presidency is that for 4 years, you can move in all of your crooked fixers, your gang of fascist thugs who treat the government like their own money box that they can take whatever they want from. And that's what happened with Nixon. And I think with Trump, he would have seen one of the most classic American traits, which is the snake oil salesman trait, the used car salesman trait, somebody who's a clear grifter, somebody who's been able to, through simple answers and through lies, convince a large or a swath of the population that greed is good, or that, again, lying is ambition. And he wouldn't have just been horrified, I think, at Donald Trump. That's clear, and I think he would have articulated that brilliantly. I think he would have been able to explain to us in a way that we desperately need now why and how somebody like Donald Trump, this snake oil salesman, is able to take over the most powerful position in American politics, and why we as a populace, even if it's only 40% of us, continually see that as an American trait. You know, when people see Trump lying, they don't think, oh, God, maybe he's lying, maybe he's not. They think, wow, this person is so talented that he can lie and still get away with it. It's like a used car salesman. If a used car salesman sells a very bad car for a ton of money, that's seen as a better talent than selling a Mercedes to somebody for the normal ticket price. And that's just that classic American grifter, ambition, American dream talent that Thompson was so keen on. And, you know, he would look at Nixon right now, and it wouldn't just be about exposing, he would look at Trump right now, and it wouldn't just be about exposing Trump's very clear criminality and illegality. It'd be about why America continues to reach out and put on a pedestal these types of people, even though we know better by now.
Who did you speak to, and how did you do the research? I mean, the writing is out there. I mean, anybody can get hold of the books, and I would urge them to do so. But who did you speak to get more of a picture of what Hunter was trying to achieve and get his mindset?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. The first thing I did was try to read everything that exists, since there is a lot of writing out there, both his own and archival material, and primary sources, but I went, one of the people that I really enjoyed speaking to, I spoke to a lot of his different colleagues, especially in the 1960s, was someone named Dr. Bob Geiger. It's who Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas is dedicated to. It's the person that he met when he moved from Colorado to Sonoma, Thompson, in 1964. In 1964, Thompson was struggling. You know, he wasn't making much money as a freelance journalist. He had a baby at the time, Juan Thompson, his son, who's a fantastic writer now, and he had a young wife, and he was really trying to make ends meet. And so Robert Geiger, Bob Geiger, who's now almost 90 and who I interviewed for a long time, he was a friend of Thompson's in Sonoma and really helped Thompson out. You know, he spent there was an incident where they were both shooting gophers at 6 a.m. On their property after a night of drinking, and the landlady came running out at them and said, "I don't care what you thought you were doing. You can't be shooting a shotgun at 6 a.m. on my property, even if it's to exterminate gophers." And so Thompson was kicked out of his house, and Geiger took Thompson in, and Thompson lived with his son and with his wife, with the Geiger family, when Thompson was at this very difficult moment in his career. And so I spoke to Bob Geiger a lot about what Thompson was like as a young journalist before he became the kind of gonzo figure that we all know today, and what the real everyday struggles were like to have a family, to have a career you weren't sure of, and to be living in a time in America that seemed as if at any moment something terrible could happen. Thompson writes there was a terrible angst on the land in one of his letters from that time. He never knew if the bomb was going to drop and kill everybody, or if we were just going to have a coup within our society and somebody was going to take over and become an extremist president. And to get a sense of the younger Thompson, to get a sense of who he was when he was in his mid-20s and he didn't have any idea that he would attain the success that he so desperately wanted, was for me really important to kind of craft this character in a novelistic way for the book itself.
Was there anything about Thompson that struck you that, you know, I always talk about eureka moment when you're researching a subject and you think you know pretty much everything there is down to the last sort of nuts and bolts, and then something comes along and it makes you think and sit up and think, that's got you. That's the point where I kind of know where you were coming from and what you were trying to achieve.
I think that his experience at 1968 in Chicago with violence, with what happens when the state orders that, and most of the world knows this, and America knows this too, but what happens when the heads of state order that you as a journalist or you as a political delegate are going to be silenced with violence, that they are going to use violence to keep you from speaking and to keep you from protesting? So Thompson had believed in nonviolent protest. He'd been there in the 1960s throughout the free speech movement, the Vietnam War movement. He'd protested and he'd also reported on it. So in 1968, when the Democratic Party tore itself apart in Chicago at its convention that August, Thompson was right there on the front lines, and he was beaten viciously by the police. And that shocked him in a way that I think surprised him, were that that violence is so effective and it's so demoralizing. And he said he left Chicago, he's written this multiple times, and all he could basically do was sob for 2 weeks at what he'd seen happen and what had happened to him. And we know that protesting is a difficult thing, and we know that we may risk violence in our protests for democracy and to uphold what we believe is right. But to also physically face that violence and then have to deal with it, it is a terrifying thing. And to see Thompson kind of digesting that, dealing with it, and see how it affected his course in life afterwards, how it pushed him back towards local politics and eventually then towards Nixon with a new fury, was for me very eye-opening and very applicable to what's going on today in America and the world, especially Europe right now too.
Do you think that a person such as Thompson in this age of 24/7 immediate news, Twitter, social media, Facebook, YouTube, you name it, news feeds, do you think that Thompson's style of writing is appropriate to what's happening now, or do you think it would just be submerged under an avalanche of talentless tweets?
Well, I think we got to believe in long form writing. You know, the New York Times right now, their magazine is doing a great job of long form writing. I think that if he were able to find a venue, which I think he would, that he could be just as effective. But to answer your question, that's dangerous. Tweeting is dangerous because it reduces the complexity, I think, of your perspective as a writer or an artist into these commodified sound bites that can be disseminated quite easily. And we're seeing that right now. And I think cable news is dangerous because it can reduce you to a sort of shouting version, caricature of yourself that then, again, reduces the complexity perhaps of your thought or of your perspective. Thompson was able and Rolling Stone to write like 8,000 to 10,000 words every 2 weeks. I mean, that's mind-blowing. It's part of the reason that he burned out. But that also gave him the space to dramatize step by step like a novelist what was going on in America at the time. And so there's a bit of a siren song in tweeting or in cable news journalism away from that long-form space. Though I do think that long-form space is as alive as ever today. And you know, he was basically like the new journalists. He was a novelist using novelistic techniques to tell the truth. And I think today there would still be a space for him to dramatize the terrible things that were happening in American society and the terrible things that are happening now. And so I would hope that he wouldn't just be sitting there on Twitter all night instead of actually opening his notebook and writing his brilliant work that he did then, and that we miss him and we wish he were writing now.
Indeed we do. The book is called Freak Kingdom. It's out now. It's come out on Public Affairs Press. Do you hope that people take a little bit more than and discover a little bit more about the man and the passion behind Hunter S. Thompson rather than just the caricature?
I mean, that's the goal of this book. I've tried to tell it like a novel, and it's really for people that are just finding out about him for the first time or might have heard something about him, but that are really upset about what's going on today in Europe and in America and how our democratic ideals are under attack. And he dealt with something very similar, and the way he dealt with it was for me very engaging and motivated me to write it. And I hope that readers will feel that same thing when they move through Freak Kingdom, you know, and its chapters.
If people want to find out more about you or buy the book, I mean, we've talked about Twitter and whatever, but do you do the social media thing? Can people find you on the internet or indeed on Twitter or social media platforms?
I'm at Twitter at Tim Denevi, and I'm also I have a website, timdenevi.com, and I do try to tweet, but I often find that if you're a writer and you're looking to not do the reading or research that you want to do, or to not write the few paragraphs you want that day, that you end up tweeting. I'm going to be trying to cover Congress and trying to cover the House of Representatives in the next few months as we see hearings that are going to be very similar to Watergate. So I'll be at Tim Denevi tweeting in the ether about that.
Well, look forward to that one. I was just going to ask you what you're up to next, but that sounds like it's going to be a fascinating period and something that Hunter would have been proud of. The book is called Freak Kingdom, Hunter S. Thompson's Manic 10-Year Crusade Against American Fascism. It's by Timothy Denevi. Timothy, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. What a great conversation.